In another special report, NBC News presents the British government crisis, the decline of the Conservative Party, the political road's end for Prime Minister Harold Macmillan, the climax of the story of the minister and the model. Now here is NBC News correspondent Chet Huntley.
What is this crisis in the purported orderly workings of the British state? Oversimplified somewhat, it began when Dr. Stephen Ward, a society osteopath and sometime artist, began sharing a young trollop, Christine Keeler, with John Profumo, the immaculate minister of war, also with a Russian military attaché, and with many more. British intelligence services, traditionally respected as the world's finest, faithfully observed and reported the sometimes congested traffic in and out of Dr. Ward's flat where Miss Keeler lived and serviced her growing clientele. Somehow, for reasons which a forthcoming investigation may determine, Prime Minister Macmillan, according to a statement in Parliament, was never informed that his war minister and a Soviet military attaché were sharing the affections of the same harlot. Some of Christine's jealous and frustrated suitors made trouble. People began to talk. Newsmen picked up spicy shards of the story. Finally, War Minister Profumo stood in the House of Commons, denied all but a perfunctory and passing acquaintance with Christine, and threatened libel and slander action against anyone who suggested more. Well, there it all lay, not rested, with wise newsmen picking at the threads which began to develop into an unseemly run. Finally, Dr. Ward began to burble, told enough to members of the opposition Labor Party and security officers that a full-scale debate and vote of confidence was scheduled for the House. Tickets for the session of Parliament yesterday were at a premium. Normally, the press gallery is only sparsely populated. Only a few tourists drift into the tiny public gallery. But yesterday it was different. The defense of Harold Macmillan against charges of incompetence, and perhaps worse, was high drama. People started to camp in line the night before to be certain of a look-in on the debate. And like all good drama, the curtain scene was not telegraphed by the actors. The tension built, and so did the drama. Television and film cameras are not permitted inside the House of Commons, a policy similar to our own Congress, but this was the scene sketched for NBC by Juliet Panett of the Illustrated London News. The Labour bench started the debate as Labour Party leader Harold Wilson stressed that Parliament was not meeting as a court of morals. Then Wilson said, "Although I acquit the Prime Minister of foreknowledge of complicity in this matter, in the misleading of the House, he cannot be acquitted of grave dereliction of duty in failing to find out." In rising to defend himself, Macmillan insisted there had been no breach of security in the Profumo-Keeler matter. But he sadly acknowledged, "My colleagues and I have been deceived, grossly deceived. The House has been deceived, but we have not been parties to the deception." As the debate continued, the British Broadcasting Company went on nationwide television with a special report by Robin Day outside the House of Commons.
Well, inside the House of Commons, across the road there, this unprecedented parliamentary debate is reaching its climax now. And in just under 2 hours' time, the vote will be taken. The debate began judicially and solemnly, though it got rowdier a little later on. Argument and facts and dates and names and letters and details piled upon the House of Commons one after the other from both Mr. Wilson and Mr. Macmillan, who were speaking more like counsel in a trial rather than the cut and thrust debaters that we know so well. Of course, the key points which have come out in this controversy today are the fact that Mr. Macmillan was not told about Sir Norman Brooke's warning in 1961 to Mr. Profumo about his friendship with Dr. Ward. Two, that he was not told by security about Miss Christine Keeler's statement to the police on January the 26th on the subject of people having given asked her to get information from Mr. Profumo. And, of course, another question is the interpret, which is still in causing doubt in many members of Parliament's mind, the interpretation of the questioning which the ministers did on the night of March 22nd and 21st to Mr. Profumo about the statement he was to make on that Friday morning. Well, Mr. Nigel Birch, who called for the Prime Minister's resignation fairly soon, he was pretty sarcastic about the minister's naivete. He said that everyone knew Mr. Profumo was not a cloistered monk and that Miss Keeler's company would not have been sought for intellectual stimulation. And this brought some laughter to the grim house. Well, Lord Lambton was also critical. But let's hear some opinions from three members of Parliament who very kindly come out of the House of Commons to see us and talk to you. Coming in very formal single file, Mr. Bill Rogers and Mr. Jeremy Thorpe. Sir Gerald Nabarro, as a Conservative Member of Parliament, are you satisfied with the explanation given by your Prime Minister?
I don't think anybody could be completely satisfied with what he said. I think he acquitted himself very well with an explicit and entirely factual statement of the course of events. His honour remains entirely unimpugned, as even Mr. Wilson admitted, and of course there is really only the issue for the public to judge on the security question. I don't dispute at all that there were very grave security risks, but I do not think that there were any security leaks or disclosures of an improper character.
What about the Prime Minister's responsibility as head of security? Do you think there is evidence here that he did not acquit himself properly in this regard?
I think that there is evidence that there were there was looseness lower down the chain of responsibility. Sir Norman Brooke, the Secretary of the Cabinet, could have reported to the Prime Minister in 1961 of the particular associations of Mr. Profumo, but he chose not to do so. Again, 18 months later, nearly 18 months later, the matter still had not been reported by MI5 to the Prime Minister.
Are you going to vote for the government?
I vote for Mr. Macmillan tonight. I think he's acquitted himself as well as possible in view of all the complex and very difficult circumstances.
Going back to what Lord Hailsham said the other night, are you voting for the government because you have had a whip or because it is in accordance with your conscience?
I vote for Mr. Macmillan tonight because I believe that he's right in what he said today in the House of Commons and because I've got conviction that I couldn't myself have done any better, and I would never vote against a man that I could not beat myself.
Thank you. Bill Rogers, Labour Member of Parliament, what is your opinion of the Prime Minister's case as made out today?
Well, I think he acquitted himself as well as he could in view of the facts. But this doesn't mean that he did very well. The truth of the matter is that he did show himself to have been incompetent insofar as he did not properly investigate the circumstances when the matter was considered on the 22nd of March.
Don't you think there's a danger that when perhaps Mr. Wilson will one day be Prime Minister, there will be similar, not necessarily security scandals, but there will be occasions when his officials may not have told him all that he needed to know because, after all, mistakes get made in security.
No, but in our system of government, it's a minister who's responsible, and this present Prime Minister has recognised that in the past. And the truth of the matter is that the Prime Minister, knowing this, should have gone out of his way, not simply to trust a colleague, which one can understand, but when the high interests of state were involved, he should have gone out of his way to have had an inquiry conducted at that time.
Can you explain to me why Mr. Wilson didn't call for a further inquiry, either a select committee, a tribunal, or a committee of privy councillors?
Well, I think that the opposition's reluctant to press the government insofar as the government now itself should take proper steps to redeem itself.
Jeremy Thorpe, as a Liberal Member of Parliament, sitting between these two great phalanxes on either side, what do you say?
Well, I think General Nabarro is right. The Prime Minister's honour is not in question, but what is in question is his general competence. And he's never answered the fact that for 11 weeks he received information and never did anything about it.
This was after March 27th.
This was March the 27th, yes. When Mr. Wilson gave him evidence which would lead one to believe that Dr. Ward was a self-confessed Russian intermediary. Nothing was done about it until 11 weeks later. And the second point, which is very important, is the Prime Minister is responsible for the security of this country. And the way in which this information came into his hands was not through his own security service, but through a national newspaper which came round to tell him of the information. The News of the World. Information which had been pretty much common knowledge and which he could perfectly easily have had investigated, and indeed should have had investigated, long before.
The debate continued into the night. George Brown, the deputy leader of the Labour Party, called for a select committee of the House to investigate the scandal. Something of that sort must be done, said Brown, if our people are to be satisfied that out of this terrible mess comes a more satisfactory way of handling our business. Another hand was raised as Joe Grimond, leader of the Labor Party, spoke to the point. The question is whether this is a competent government. And the Liberal continued, I know it is said the Prime Minister will stay on for a short time and then quietly be pushed aside. If the Prime Minister must go, the time for him to go is now. There is no possible excuse for having a caretaker government at this moment. Then the vote of confidence. Macmillan won it, but only by a 69-vote majority. And in the rain, outside the House of Commons, BBC correspondent Robin Day summed it up.
Well, of course, that government majority of 69 is between 25 and 30 below the government's paper majority, which stands at 97. A comment on the meaning of that in a moment from Robert Carville of the Evening Standard. Now, the debate was wound up for the government by Ian McLeod, leader of the House of Commons, one of the ministers who grilled Mr. Profumo on the night of March 22nd and 21st about his statement which he was to make in the morning. Well, Mr. McLeod's speech mainly consisted of a series of explanations as to why the ministers had to believe Mr. Profumo. And he emphasized and pointed out that the knowledge that the letter was in the hands of somebody or other, newspapers or Miss Keeler, the letter beginning Darling, was in itself, the ministers thought, an assurance that Mr. Profumo would not and indeed could not lie. But he said this didn't happen and so we were wrong. But he replied to Mr. George Brown's suggestion that the House of Commons should set up a select committee to inquire into this whole business. Mr. McLeod said he wasn't shutting the door to that, but he did suggest that they should also discuss the possibility of a committee of privy councillors to discuss the security side, and then possibly an independent tribunal of the sort that looked into the Vassal case. Well, that was how Mr. McLeod ended up, and then the division came, and when the government majority, lower than many people had expected, was announced, there were loud cries of resign. Now, word from Robert Carville, if you'd come forward between the umbrellas, have our members of Parliament. Robert Carville, how do you interpret this majority?
Well, this has been a vote of confidence for Macmillan, but a very unsatisfactory one indeed. He left the House looking extremely solemn and tensed up just now, a moment or two ago.
The other night on Gallery, you said that if he lost about 25 votes, he'd be in difficulties.
In fact, he's lost, I reckon at a quick count, he's lost about 26. He's 26 light votes fewer than he might have been tonight. This, I think, is enough to rock the tree. The question is whether or not it's going to knock any of the apples off. I would have thought that Macmillan's living on borrowed time, but whether he stays as Prime Minister for weeks or months remains to be seen.
The last time a Prime Minister resigned because of a vote like this in the House of Commons was in 1940, wasn't it?
Ah, yes, but that
figures
vote
were
was,
very
the figures were very, very different indeed. And
33
that,
against
that,
the government.
At that time, about 70 actually voted with the opposition.
Yeah.
Well, so far as we can see, no Tories have been voting with the opposition tonight, although a number has sat tight.
33 then voted for the opposition and 80 abstained in 1940. Very
yeah.
different from tonight.
Very different.
However, Mr. George Wigg, anything else you want to say, Robert Carville, on the interpretation of this?
No, I think the government obviously has been very seriously shaken, and we'll have to wait a day or two until the dust settles before we know just where things are.
Right. Thank you very much. Come back in a moment if you've got anything else to say. Mr. George Wigg, what do you pick out as the thing which the opposition finds most unsatisfactory about the Prime Minister's reply?
Well, the Prime Minister...
Or Mr. McLeod?
Both the Prime Minister and Mr. McLeod seem to have avoided taking any steps to establish the truth of any situation. They didn't go to the police. The police reports didn't come in. The security reports didn't come to them. The newspaper reports came in. They took no notice. This is a record not of dishonourable men, but a record of incompetent men. And two things need to be done, and done speedily. Restore the confidence of the army, which has been badly shaken, but equally important, to reconstruct the security services so the kind of breakdowns that have happened on this occasion can never happen again.
Thank you. Mr. Peter Kirk, could you come forward, please?
Yes.
Can you tell us, first of all, whether you voted for the government or
no,
not?
No, I didn't. I abstained.
You abstained. Could
yes.
you explain why, Mr. Kirk?
Yes, I think basically because of the statement of the leader of the House, Mr. McLeod, that on the 28th of January, the Solicitor General knew that a statement had been made by Miss Keeler involving Mr. Profumo. This was a totally new bit of information we hadn't had before, which convinced me that the whole situation should have been investigated a good deal earlier than it was.
This decision caused you considerable anxiety.
Naturally, yes. and doesn't like to vote against one's party, or even abstain from voting on a vote of competence.
Had anything else worried you before that, or was it just this little piece of information?
Oh, no, the last straw? Naturally, I was worried the whole way through, and one is. I said this earlier on in Panorama, as you know. Worried by the whole operation of the affair and the fact the Prime Minister didn't seem to know and nobody told him what was going on at any stage. This final piece of information, that one of his own ministers knew this and nobody bothered to tell him, convinced me that something was seriously wrong.
Is your charge on this point or the other points one of dishonour or incompetence or negligence?
Nothing to do with honour at all.
No?
Absolutely nothing. I'm sure the Prime Minister's honour, I'm sure even George Wigg would agree with me here, it's absolutely vindicated on the whole matter at all. It's a matter of the failure of the security services for the umpteenth time, and we've had this over and over again, to coordinate their activities in a way that makes sense. This is what worried me.
Robert Carville, did you want to come through and say something?
No, I don't think so. I think the situation's so fluid here, even under the umbrellas, that there's not very much I want to say at this moment.
George Wigg, let me put one final question to you, if I have time. And that is this. All right, maybe there was incompetence here. Maybe people weren't told what they ought to have been told. But may not there come a time under a Labour Prime Minister or you as a Labour Minister when somebody won't tell you something which they ought to? Some policeman will forget to tell you.
Well, if I was a minister and I wasn't told, I should find out. That's what ministers are for.
But how could the Prime Minister find out if Sir Norman Brooke didn't tell him something?
Oh, well, look...
The Secretary to the Cabinet.
If Sir Norman Brooke didn't tell him, the newspapers told him, the Prime Minister is not living up in an ivory tower. He heard all the rumours. But what he hoped to do, as Profumo hoped to do, he hoped to get away with it, as they got away with it on many other occasions. And this occasion, it didn't work.
Bob Carville, a final prediction on when the Prime Minister will leave office.
I should say by the end of the summer.
The British press has been unrelenting in its coverage of the Profumo case, and the leading cartoonists have been turned loose on the story. Franklin in the Mirror showed Profumo spattering mud all over Harold Macmillan's fancy uniform, which is labeled Tory General Election Parade Dress. Cummings in the Daily Express showed Prime Minister Macmillan's face-saving cosmetics blowing up in his face. The powder puff carries the caption, Profumo's Original Denial Statement. Illingworth in the Daily Mail shows the Tory leaders at a banquet with rotting fish under the table and with clothespins on their noses. They're saying, smell, what smell? Giles, also appearing in the Daily Express, takes a lighter approach, showing a big diplomatic reception where all the men dive out the window as the butler announces, ladies and gentlemen, Miss Chris, and shattering glass drowns out the second syllable. And a weekly humor magazine, Private Eye, hits hard with a cartoon takeoff on the Conservatives' campaign slogan, We've Never Had It So Good. Harold Macmillan is shown as a sign painter who has just changed the slogan to read, We've Never Had It So Often. It seems tonight that when this British government scandal has run its course, one salutary effect may be a change in Britain's stringent libel laws. British journalism has long smarted under one of the toughest libel laws in the world. Further, the Official Secrets Act has mitigated against journalists' revelations which might have been of significant public value. And although the British press did go full tilt in their coverage of the Profumo case, press leaders point out that they were prevented for many long weeks from revealing to the public the facts about John Profumo and Christine Keeler. The newsmen call attention to Profumo's denial of impropriety before the House of Commons on the 22nd of March when he said, I shall not hesitate to issue writs for libel and slander if scandalous allegations are made or repeated outside the House. 2 days ago, the London Sunday Express commented, Mr. Profumo believed that he could keep the truth from the public by using the law of libel as a bludgeon to divert the course of justice. And within the week, Gavin Astor, publisher of the highly respected London Times, said the Profumo-Keeler case never would have been uncovered if it had not been for the public press. He criticized Britain's Official Secrets Act, the law of libel, and the rules of contempt of court, all aimed at the journalists of television, radio, and press. They can have the effect, said Mr. Astor, of imposing a silence and clamping a gag on the press, and this has often prevented the newspapers from giving information which the public has a right to know. When Admiralty Clerk William Vassal was revealed to be a homosexual who was blackmailed into spying for the Soviet Union, he was sent to jail. But so were two London reporters who refused to reveal their sources for the stories which uncovered the Vassal case. That was last March, and the London Times warned that the government had taken over power from Parliament. Whatever else comes out of this scandal, the British newspapers, much maligned and very often tastelessly flamboyant, may benefit most. But the question tonight still remains, what now for Harold Macmillan? A veteran observer of the British political scene is NBC's senior European correspondent Joseph C. Harsh, who tape-recorded this commentary at the conclusion of the parliamentary debate.
Maurice Harold Macmillan, age 69, now joins the ranks of those statesmen who failed to quit when they were ahead of the game. Even to a month ago, he could have stepped aside with dignity, honors, and acclaim. His record had been impressive. Gallant soldier in World War I, courageous politician in the trying days which led to World War II, important architect of modern conservatism, and the man who picked Britain up, dusted her off, and repaired her relations with us after the crash landing of Suez. The climactic tragedy of this man's career came in the House of Commons yesterday afternoon when he ended his defense on the Profumo case by saying, "I claim, upon a fair view of the facts as I have set them out, that I'm entitled to the sympathetic understanding and confidence of the House and of the country." To be in the House at that time, to see and to hear, was to know that Harold Macmillan had lost touch with reality. There was some sympathy for him, even on the opposition benches, but little understanding and no confidence. By his own admission, he had repeatedly chosen to believe John Profumo, regardless of the damning, squalid evidence everyone else could see. He had twice guessed wrong on security matters. First, when he sacked Thomas Galbraith over the Vassal spy case, and Galbraith was then found to be totally innocent. Second, when he so mistakenly clung to Profumo. The two cases of bad judgment were in the foreground in yesterday's debate. In the background was the fact that Macmillan leadership had seemed to have gone to pieces from the moment Charles de Gaulle of France vetoed Britain's application for the European Common Market. The Profumo case did not bring Harold Macmillan down. It was the last straw which convinced the House of Commons that there was no longer firm or purposeful leadership at the helm of state. Harold Macmillan today is a lame duck prime minister. He will be dropped when the Tory party has reached agreement on his successor. The time is expected to come in late July or early August. It seems curious that a president of the United States should still be planning to visit Harold Macmillan under these circumstances so distressing to the host. Joseph C. Harsh, NBC News, London.
Actually, the Profumo case has excited little attention in Washington. In fact, in rather a strange way, Macmillan's plight underlines the period of great political uncertainty in Europe. And it's for this reason that President Kennedy will visit the continent. NBC's State Department correspondent Ellie Abel reports from Washington.
Official Washington, that is to say the White House and the State Department, tend to give Prime Minister Macmillan the benefit of the doubt so far as personal responsibility for the handling of the Profumo scandal is concerned. The feeling here is that Macmillan may have bumbled and fluffed, but that he probably told the truth as far as he knew it. That he may, in short, have been a victim of his own rigid code that gentlemen do not inquire into the private lives of other gentlemen too closely. President Kennedy will go through with his visit to Britain. Even before the more lurid details came out, the president had not expected to negotiate anything with Macmillan, just to talk over in broad outline such long-term problems as the future of the Atlantic Alliance, the upcoming nuclear test ban talks in Moscow, the feasibility of constructing a NATO fleet of Polaris-armed surface ships. It now seems clear that Macmillan will have to step down before long, and the British government can hardly be expected to undertake any major new commitments for a time. One possible objection to the president's British stopover has ironically been swept aside by the Profumo affair. There is no longer any concern here lest Macmillan try to use the Kennedy visit for electioneering. Washington feels the prime minister is in too deep to be rescued, even if Mr. Kennedy wanted to throw him a line. Nor is Washington terribly worried over a possible Labour victory. Harold Wilson, the new Labour Party leader, had comparatively few admirers here before his recent visit to Washington, but he apparently impressed President Kennedy and Undersecretary of State Ball, among others, quite favorably. The old reflex reaction that labor necessarily means trouble seems to have disappeared. Ellie Abel, NBC News, Washington.
The John Profumo-Christine Keeler case is just the latest event in the steady decline of the Conservative Party in England and concurrently England in the eyes of the world. You might say it all started to build in the late 40s when Guy Burgess and Donald McLean, both homosexuals, both alcoholics, used their Foreign Office positions to spy for the Russians. There followed a sordid list of spy cases and misadventures. In March of 1961, five persons were convicted of spying on Britain's underwater detection establishment at the Portland Naval Base. In May of 1961, George Blake, another Foreign Office aide, went to jail for spying for the Soviet Union. In October of 1962, Admiralty clerk John Christopher Vassal, a homosexual, was blackmailed into spying for the Reds. In December of 1962, Prime Minister Macmillan misjudged the temper of the British people when he acceded to American plans to drop the Skybolt missile in favor of Polaris submarines for the defense of Britain. In January of 1963, Britain's bid to enter the European common market was vetoed by France. In March of 1963, the Profumo case started to come to the fore, and John Profumo, in an appearance before Parliament, lied to its members about his relationships with Christine Keeler. In the same week, the Conservatives lost still another by-election, seeing their strength being chipped away in the hinterlands. On June 5th, 1963, Profumo submitted his resignation, admitting that he had lied to his colleagues and to the Parliament. On June 8th, Dr. Stephen Ward, Profumo's friend, was arrested and charged with living off the earnings of prostitutes. And then yesterday, the shaky vote of confidence in the House of Parliament, a vote which almost certainly will lead to the downfall of Prime Minister Harold Macmillan. The London of Gladstone, Disraeli, and the Pitts was a massive, gray granite eminence built to rule. Constructed only for Englishmen, she would have been a modest little city. But she was designed to administer a good part of the world. She was buttressed, broad-domed, and towered. She had time to develop taste and manners. But that London is unemployed. This is where sun-tanned empire men once walked in shining boots, where patrician couples strolled in serene self-assurance, where insurance policies and bank loans were contracted over the sherry and with a nod of the head. These are the replacements for the leathered clubs where Englishmen guarded their privacy. The string quartets, the chamber music, and the literary clubs have given way to the sleazy striptease, and the barrel house cacophony of the skiffle is an unbelievable descendant of the stately minuet. But it might be wise to hesitate a while before writing off London, the people who own it, and the system of society and government which it represents. England has been through similar trials before this. A soul-sickened, disgusted, weary, and angry Wordsworth, observing the spoil about him, cried out for Milton in the year 1802. He wrote, "Milton, thou shouldst be living at this hour. England hath need of thee. She is a fen of stagnant waters. Alder, sword, and pen, fireside, the heroic wealth of hall and bower have forfeited their ancient English dower of inward happiness. We are selfish men. Oh, raise us up, return to us again, and give us manners, virtue, freedom, power." Chet Huntley, NBC News. Good night.